Welcome to another Leon Chani Report, and the first guest is Brigitte Gabriel, who is a Christian Lebanese. She's got a hell of a story. We're going to get into that in a minute. Then we're going to talk about the elections, and thereafter, Houdini. What a show. It's all magic. Because they hate. This is a fascinating story of a woman called Gabrielle, who was born in Lebanon and survived Islamic terror. Now, you've probably seen her on Fox News 100 times, right?
Yes.
Right? They love you on Fox News. All right, let's start. You were born where?
I was born in South Lebanon, in a little town called Marjayoun.
How far is that from the Israeli border?
It's about 4 kilometers from the Israeli border. Not that far.
All right. When you were small, you knew about Israel?
I knew about Israel because I used to watch television. My father owned a restaurant, and we had the first TV in town, and a lot of people would come to eat dinner at my father's restaurant and watch the evening news. And my introduction to Israel was what I heard on the news every night. Israel, Azrael. Azrael is the name of the devil. The Jews are evil.
You heard it in Hebrew or Arabic?
In Arabic. The Arabic, the Lebanese government, the Arabic official Lebanese.
No, but the Israelis broadcast also news in Arabic.
Yes. Yes, they did.
And so you were able to get that in Lebanon? Oh, it's interesting.
Yes, we were able to get that in Lebanon too. But most of the people watched Lebanese television.
Right. But when you got the Israeli broadcast, did you think it was propaganda or did you think it was truthful?
We never really watched Israeli news that much. Plus, I was a child. I mean, I was under 10 years old when all this was
bright.
Going on.
You're bright. You pick up quick.
Thank you. So I used to pick up the news. You know, they would show the evening news, the Palestinians coming into Lebanon. And I would hear conversations all around and on television that the only time we will have peace in the Middle East is when we kill all the Jews and throw them into the sea. And this was what I heard on the radio. This was what news anchors always repeated on television. This was the conversations around the tables in my father's restaurant. That was my idea or what I heard about Israel. In my home, I wasn't taught hate because I come from a Christian family.
Right.
But all around me in Lebanon, that was the teaching. The Lebanese thought if they can get closer to the Arabic world or identify with the Arabic world, it will earn them brownie point protection in the eyes of the huge, large Muslim community that surrounded us. But that theory proved wrong because when the killing started and when the Muslims started killing the Christians in Lebanon, it didn't make a difference if you were a leftist Christians who fought for the Islamic rights, more Islamic rights in the government, or who fought for the Palestinians. They killed all Christians if they were left or right.
Are you talking about 82 when there was the war?
No, I'm talking before the war.
Really?
I'm talking even 1975. In 1975, the Palestinians and the Muslims in Lebanon put their forces together and created an army called Jaysh Lebanon al-Arabi, the Arabic Lebanese army, and started taking over the military bases. In their attempt to take over my town, they bombed my home, bringing it down and burying me under the rubble wounded, and I ended up living in a bomb shelter from age 10 to age 17, fighting for my life.
These were the Islamics?
These were the Muslims, yes.
If I say Jemael, you know them? You remember them?
Of course I do.
I met them personally in Tel Aviv at the defense office of Ezer Weitzman. There were two brothers, right?
Yes.
One was assassinated?
Yes.
And they were
Amin and Bashir Jemail. Right. Bashir was assassinated.
Where are they? One was studying at Harvard, I remember. Is that correct?
I think so. Most of the Christian Lebanese usually go to college outside of Lebanon, either the Sorbonne in France or Harvard in the United States or Oxford in England. And this is part of the problem because when the war began in Lebanon, when the Muslims declared holy war on the Christians didn't know how to fight. They were the educated ones.
Right.
And Israel actually took the Christian forces from Lebanon into Israel and trained them.
General Lahad.
Yes.
He did SLA, right? Southern Lebanese
Correct.
Army.
He was the head of the South Lebanese Army.
And he's now living in Paris?
Haddad died, and Lahad, the second general,
Lahad,
you met
him.
Yes, he's living in Paris right now.
He had a bad arm.
He was shot.
Yeah, but that was about women, not in battle. Everybody thought he was shot because it was...
No, it was actually an infiltrator, a spy that the Muslims hired, and she became very close to the family, spent a lot of time in the family, and one night she was having dinner at their home, and she was sitting closer to him than you and I are sitting, and she just pulled the gun out of her pocket and shot him in his chest.
So that's a scoop, because everybody was told that this was some kind of romantic tryst. That's interesting.
No, she was a spy planted, became very close friend with his wife and the children.
Really?
They trusted her in the house, and she assassinated him. They played dirty.
Wow. What is the cause, in your opinion, of Islamic terrorism? Why? Is it the Quran, the way they read it? What is it?
It is the Quran. It is the words of the
Quran
Prophet Muhammad.
Right, but it could be a good book, too. It's how you interpret it, right?
No, not really. The Quran is the Quran. We're not talking about interpretation. If you take the words of the Prophet Muhammad himself,
right.
In the beginning, when he formed Islam, he started preaching peace for the Muslims and the Christians, for the Jews and the Christians, hoping to attract the Jews and the Christians to accept him as a prophet.
Then he was upset that the Jews didn't get along with him.
The Jews refused him
right.
because his own people in Mecca did not accept him. He went to Medina appealing to the Jews. They refused him. And that's when all the verses in the Quran started changing. And there's a law of abrogation in the Quran. If you have two verses in the Quran that are contradicting each other, the latter verse is the true verse and wipes off the first verse. So the Quran, the Muslim followers now know that it is the law of taqiyya, which is lying. This is why when you see a lot of talking Muslim heads on American television, talking to Western audiences who are not familiar with the Quran and they quote all the nice, wonderful verses in the Quran about the Christians and the Jews, they are not discussing, under the law of taqiyya, the lie that the second verses wipe off the first verses.
Who wrote the second verse?
Muhammad himself. These are Muhammad's words. Once the Jews refused
to accept
him.
So you're saying that if you read literally the Quran, you can never have peace? Are you saying that to me?
People who are the true observant Muslims, who abide by the Quran and believe the words of the Prophet, forget any other books, the words of the Prophets, they will not have peace with the Jews and the Christians who are considered infidels. Remember, the Prophet said Jews and Christians are apes and pigs because they are cursed by Allah.
That's very depressing.
It is very sad. What needs to be done in Islam is the moderate Muslims need to come forward. They need to be challenged. Islam needs reform. Judaism and Christianity went through reform. In our Bible, there are verses in the Bible that are bad. The tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye. We have very bad, nasty things in the Bible. However, you don't see any Jews in the 21st century strapping bombs on their bodies and going into mosques and blowing up mosques.
All right, we got to explain this. I happen to know a little bit about religion. If you take the text of any religion literally, you're going to come out at a zero place. If you bring in the interpretations, if you take the Torah literally, the Jewish five books of Moses literally, then people can stretch that to any imagination they want. So the Jews were pretty clever. They created a Talmud and explanations and ways to seek peace. I'm sure you can do the same with the Quran. I'm sure that the people who interpret those words, look, there were Jews called Karaites who interpreted literally every sentence of Judaism, I mean of the Torah, the five books of Moses. So what you need is people who are willing to accept that these books were written a long time ago and that civilization has progressed and things have changed.
Exactly. Islam needs reform.
Right. So it needs to be reformed. Otherwise, we can all go home. It's going to be a very depressive place.
Exactly. And this is a sad reality that we're facing an enemy in the 21st century who is fighting based on an ideology from the 7th century. And this is why all the terrorists who have been Muslim, radical Muslims, all leave videos, their last rite before they die, that Al Jazeera plays on television. And they are reciting verses from the Quran. And this is what we are seeing over and over and over. Even the Pentagon released a study last month. And they have proven that the Quran is the driving force behind martyrdom operations and terrorists and so Muslim terrorists. So this
is an
issue.
I have no doubts. If you read any of those books literally, you wouldn't be talking to me. You're a Christian, I'm a Jew. If you took that literally, I don't think you'd be too happy with me, you know? And if you followed your pope in certain times of the historical centuries that we talk about, you might be angry at me. So unless we get liberal interpretation
of
these holy books, then we're in for jihad all the time. I mean, it's just forever. It's forever.
Exactly. We need to get out of the tribal mentality. In the Middle East, when you look at the Middle East, you are looking at every country. There are tribes with flags. They need to get out of the tribal mentality. And it's a challenge for the Muslims who are living in the West to say, we are living in Western civilizations. We appreciate democracy. We value women and women's rights. We value Jews and Christians. We value humanity as groups who need to come together and work together.
How do we do that, Brigitte?
There are reformists in Islam. Sadly, they are living undercover. It's like the witness protection program. They are afraid for their lives. There are out there. I work with few of them. And they are trying their best to sound the alarm.
What if that was Salman Rushdie? Where is he?
Look at the fatwa with Salman Rushdie. You know, I was surprised. He's actually coming out lately in public.
He's meeting a lot of women. I see he's dancing, you know. he's doing a jig someplace.
I guess he realized there are so many enemies right now of Islam. They've got a pool of people to pick on instead of him alone.
So you write this book because they hate. So briefly, what should one get when one reads this book? One gets hope or one gets anger, one gets feelings of despair. We're reading your book. People are going to read this book. If you're on this show, people will read the book. What will they get out of this book?
They're going to get educated about the background of the conflict. They're going to realize that the conflict did not start with 9/11, that Muslims have been declaring holy war on Christians worldwide prior to 9/11. That they're going to be inspired, they're going to be motivated, they're going to feel sad, they're going to feel depressed, they're going to feel empowered, all at the same time.
They'll need a pharmacist if they do this. They'll need medicine.
Not really, because look at me. I survived the war, and I came out of it stronger than ever, and I'm here in the United States. I have attained the American dream, and I'm doing my part as a patriotic citizen to do whatever I can to change the minds of American who are apathetic about the situation to get involved and make a difference. I founded an organization called AmericanCongressForTruth.org, a nonprofit organization to educate Americans, to empower Americans, to network Americans who want to come together and solve the problems and work on issues to protect our country and defend our democracy. So they're going to be empowered and they're going to be inspired.
You lived in Israel for a time?
I lived in Israel from 1984 till 1989. I worked there as news anchor for World News.
Did you have a problem getting in there, getting your passports or anything like that? Was it troublesome?
Not at all. I had special clearances. I went in and out every weekend, actually, because I worked in Jerusalem 5 days
a
week and
you
went to Lebanon.
As a reporter, right?
News anchor for World News, yes. No problem at all. I had to go through security checks, profiling every weekend, every time I entered.
That's what I mean.
No problem.
How did you get the job there?
How did I get the job? That's a long story.
See, she's smiling.
I met the bureau chief.
You got time. This is not the Charlie Rose show. You got time. Tell us the story.
I wanted to work in Israel, and as an only child, I wanted to provide for my family because my family had no income. My parents were old. My father lost all his life savings when our house was bombed. My parents were in their mid-70s when I was 20 years old.
Are they alive today?
No, they died.
Sorry.
And they are actually buried on Mount Zion along with Oscar Schindler because I wanted to ensure my children will always be pulled to Israel.
Really?
Yes.
You're a Zionist, a Christian Zionist.
I am a Christian Zionist. And I did this 17 years ago before I ever knew I will ever be speaking to you or becoming an advocate for Israel or creating an organization educating people about Israel and its enemies and how Israel's enemies are now America's enemies or Western civilization's enemies. Because, Leon, I believe actions speak louder than words. We see a lot of talking heads on many TV stations, and empty talking is hot air, empty verbiage. My parents taught me one thing in life. They said, don't tell people how you feel. Show them with your actions where you stand on everything in life. And this is what I did. And so taking care of my parents were my world because they had me very late in life. They were married for over 22 years. They couldn't have any children. My mother was 55 years old and my father was 60 when I was born.
Really?
Yeah. So
Wow. When
I became...
It's probably the oldest birth in Lebanon, no?
I guess. I don't know.
55 years old.
My father was 60.
Wow.
So I had to take care of my parents. My father was a businessman, a wealthy businessman. We had real estate. But during the war, our homes were empty. Our restaurant was closed. My father's money, all the cash that he had taken out of Beirut, out of the banks to bring us to America, was burned to ashes when my home was destroyed.
Wow.
And he became deaf at age 70. So I was the sole supporter of the family.
All right, hold it. We're going to cut for a break. We'll come back and hear some tantalizing stories here from Brigitte Gabriel, who's written this book called Because They Hate. And obviously, there's a lot of hate in this world. We'll talk a little bit about the Shiites and the Sunnis. They also don't love each other that much, and they read the same Quran. And then we'll find out how you can be a Christian Zionist. Well, it's interesting. Usually, Zionists are Jews, but maybe we have an anomaly here. We'll be right back.
Look, Mom, no hands. full life, measured in seats, starts with the right ones early on. Car crashes are the number one killer of children 1 through 13. Learn how to prevent deaths and injuries by using the right car seat for your child's age and size.
Kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
Every book is an adventure waiting to come to life. Visit new worlds. Encounter new friends. And discover the power of reading. Go to read.gov to read A Princess of Mars, the first novel to feature John Carter. A new world awaits. Read.
The average text takes your eyes off the road for nearly 5 seconds.
Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. Go to discovertheforest.org.
Osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
We're back with Brigitte Gabrielle, who's a Lebanese Christian, who is now a Christian Zionist. That's a tremendous story. We're going to get into that. She's going to tell me what the difference is between the Sunnis and the Shiites. I mean, basically, I know it's because Muhammad didn't have any male heirs, so he had to dribble down to cousins and brother-in-laws and all that. We'll get into that in a minute. Then we'll bring on Susan Del Persico, who's a Republican strategist. I think she's a Republican strategist today, too. She was yesterday. Mm-hmm. And she's going to wrap up the election for us. And after that, what else? Houdini. After the Republican election, you got to talk with Houdini. These are two fellows who wrote a book about Houdini, and they claim that Houdini was a spy for the United States. Pretty interesting. Brigitte, you're a powerful, a peripatetic lady with a lot of energy.
Thank you.
And I haven't met that many Christian Zionists, so tell me what a Christian Zionist is. Is that a lover of Israel?
Yes, I love Israel. And I want to talk about Israel from I'm not a born-again Christian. I was born into the Christian faith. I'm a Maronite Lebanese. As a civilized human being, remove all religion out of it, as a civilized human being who is well-educated and well-informed, how can I not take the side of Israel in spite of everything that's going on around them? Look what Israel has contributed to the world in medicine, in technology, in humanity, in humanitarian aid. When the earthquake happened in Iran 2 years ago, it was Israel who first offered to send the humanitarian aid and help to the enemy that now was talking about wiping Israel off the map. It was Iran who rejected Israel. So how can I, as a civilized human being, not love Israel and appreciate what these people have contributed and what they have created in a very short period of time, in 50 years? They have created one of the best countries in the world, an oasis in the middle of the desert in the Middle East. This is where I view Israel. And I respect and love the Jews, not only because they helped me and saved my mother's life when my mother was wounded and I ended up spending 22 days in a hospital in Israel.
Which one?
The Fat Hospital. It's Fat.
It's Fat.
And my
it's
mother.
It's a very holy place, Fat.
Yes, it is. And I'll never forget my mother. They brought her into the emergency room to treat her. And there were hundreds of people wounded on the floor. There were Muslim militia brought in from Lebanon, Palestinian terrorists brought in from Lebanon, Christians and Israelis. The doctors treated everyone according to their injury. They did not see religion. They did not see political affiliation. They did not see nationality. They saw people in need and they helped. The doctor treated my mother before he treated the Israeli soldier laying next to her because her injury was more severe. I spent 3 weeks in that hospital. Those weeks changed the way I look at information, I evaluate information. I realized the Arabic world is fed a lie by its government about the Jews that was so far from reality. And I vowed that one day I will go back to Israel and work in Israel because these people had values. I experienced the human compassion at that hospital and civilization that I knew my country would not be able to show their enemy in their most trying moments.
Do you ever go back to Lebanon, by the way?
No.
Do you have any relatives there?
I have distant relatives, but because
Where
of the
Where were you educated?
In Lebanon.
Really?
In the bomb shelter. Education is very important to Christians.
No, where'd you go to university? Not a bomb shelter.
I never went to university. I self-educated myself.
Really?
And I learned English watching television in my bomb shelter and writing subtitles on my arm. I never studied English at school.
Really?
Yes, and I was able to write a book and sit here with you in New York and communicate.
It's pretty impressive.
Goes to show you where there is a will, there's a way.
You sure you don't have Jewish blood?
I have Lebanese Christian Phoenician blood. Remember, we all come back from the same place.
I got to tell you that I got a few calls, aside from Milton Miller, who's my assistant producer from time to time, from a couple of Israelis who said they heard you speak someplace, and they asked that I bring you on to the show, and I said I already had you booked for the show. Have the Israeli government been in touch with you at all? The foreign ministry people?
No.
No?
No. No. Haven't you heard that Israelis are bad at PR? You know, so it's really sad. No, they have not.
Really?
They have not. And I would love to work with the Israeli government. I think I can make the case for Israel as a Lebanese, as a non-Jew, much more effective than a Jewish person can make it. Because if you and I say the same words, people look at you and say, well, he's Jewish, of course he loves Israel. But when it comes from somebody who's a Lebanese, who was raised in a society that hated the Jews, that taught hatred against the Jews, and then I ended up going to Israel and working in Israel as news anchor for World News. I didn't have any job cleaning, you know, or any small job. I never felt discriminated against. I was never treated as a second-class citizen. I was treated with the utmost respect, even when I went to the Ministry of Interior to get a license to bury my parents in Jerusalem.
Do you still practice Christianity?
No.
Why don't you convert? It'll be easier.
You know, I tried to convert in Jerusalem twice, and they kicked me out of the temple.
Why?
Because they make it very tough on anyone who wants to convert.
Go see the Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. They'll help you.
Well, you know, I am more effective as a non-Jew, as a Christian speaking up for Israel, so maybe it was meant to be. You know, it was Besheret.
Yeah, but we need you because Jews give 10% of their income away, and the way you're going, you're going to have a lot of income.
From your mouth to God's ear.
So you got to help fund.
We have a lot of good things to do with the income that can come. There's a lot of things that need to be fixed in this world.
All right, Sunnis and Shiites, why are they fighting each other?
Oh, Sunnis and Shiites, like you mentioned earlier in the show, because Muhammad didn't have any ears, and it was to who's going to pass
right.
the baton, basically. And so the Sunnis, Muhammad, you know, Ali came, and Ali, who is the Shiite leader, and Ali believes he is the one who was given the baton to pass, and the Sunnis do not agree with that. However, that's just a little minute religious difference. They fight with each other like tooth and nails, like diehard enemies. But when it comes to them fighting against the enemy, they will come together as one, no matter what enemies they are within each other, to fight the infidel. And the perfect example is this latest war between Hezbollah and Israel and Gaza. Gaza in the Palestinian territory, the Hamas in Gaza, Hamas are Sunnis.
Right.
Hezbollah in Lebanon are Shiites.
But they got together.
They got together as one to fight Israel. And this is a message that the West truly needs to understand. We should not put them in different compartments and say, the Sunnis and the Shiites are not getting along, and therefore maybe we can get in and they'll be our friends. Don't kid yourself. We cannot kid ourselves. They both will come together as one to fight us as infidels, no matter what the issue. When the things boil down to life and death, it's them against us.
And what about Iran?
Iran is a huge danger. Iran right now is basically behind all the insurgency in Iraq. It is Iran who is financing and supporting Hezbollah. Hezbollah developed the IED, the side road explosives that now they are using against our troops in Iraq and in Afghanistan, sent to Iraq via Syria through Lebanon. Iran right now is eyeing Iraq. Iran has had its eyes on Iraq for the last 20 years. Remember, them and he, Iran and Saddam Hussein have been fighting in a race for nuclear development technology. Right now, if we withdraw the troops out of Iraq, and this is exactly what Iran is looking at, they're rejoicing that the Democrats were elected. Iran, if we withdraw our troops, and I hope that the Democrats would never come to such a very ill-informed decision.
Well, we'll ask Susan when she comes on.
That's right. But Iran will sweep into Iraq. They will work with the Muqtada Sadr movement, take over Iraq. Afghanistan will fall like a bird. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan will be in jeopardy. And this is why Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan sided with, actually condemned Hezbollah with the war, because they know Iran is the strongest country right now in the Middle East, and they will take over. And Saudi Arabia, they cannot fight it. So this is a major problem. We're looking at an Islamic Khalifa, possibly, from India to the Mediterranean, headed by Iran. So I hope the Democrats will have their heads straight. I doubt it.
There may be people in this audience who believe you. If I were a neophyte and I didn't know much about Islamic fundamentalism or Islam, period, what book would I read aside from your book? How would I get a good basic understanding of Islam? A lot of Americans don't know.
The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam by Robert Spencer. It was released last year. You can find it on Amazon.com. And Robert Spencer just released a new book titled The Truth About Muhammad. And it's about the life of Muhammad and what Muhammad taught and how Muhammad led by example. Because remember, the Muslims look at Muhammad as the al-insan al-kamil, the perfect man, the man to follow as the example. So he studies, he points out in the book how Muhammad lived as a warrior, how he fought, what he taught, and why Muslims all throughout the world emulate him.
All right, we're running out of time. Brigitte, it's a pleasure to hear you. Tell me the truth. You're going to celebrate Hanukkah or Christmas this year?
Actually, we always celebrate Hanukkah. We invite all our Jewish friends, and we have a Hanukkah party, and then we have a Christmas party.
I'm confounded here. So you're half Jewish? There are people who say that if you take the culture of Judaism, you become Jewish, by the way. You don't have to convert. People who say that.
Then I'm a proud honorary Jew.
50 rabbis will call me now and email me, say, what am I, nuts? But there is some people who say that today. So you're.
Then I can proudly say I'm an honorary Jew.
Really? All right. Pleasure to have you, Brigitte.
Thank you very much.
Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
And you proved that you don't have to go to college to learn how to speak.
Can you consider with me? Imagine what you'd see if every child had a book to read.
Cause every kid across the nation deserves a book to read, and we can make it happen right now.
No, I don't know what you've been told,
but kids with books learn so much more.
Read to a child today and spark a lifetime of ambition.
Who says you can't teach an old dog new tricks? Maybe you should go to your shelter and get a mature dog who will make your blues disappear. How's that for tricks? I got picked. Wow.
Mom, can I have a dollar?
Yeah, that's right. I think my purse is upstairs on the bed.
It's not here.
Check the dining room.
No.
What about your sister's room?
It's not there either.
The upstairs closet? The downstairs closet?
There are no more closets.
Moms everywhere are finding ways to keep kids active and healthy. Get ideas, get involved, get going at letsmove.gov.
So we brought on Stephen Eric Brano, who was a professor of political science at Rutgers University, who was trotting down the street one day and saw the protocols of the learned elders of Zion and said, you know, what is this all about? How do I connect this thing? So he sat down, wrote a book for St. Martin's Press, and he's here today to discuss it. So, first of all, what causes anti-Semitism? Easy question.
Easy question. That's been debated since time immemorial.
Right.
I guess the losers of society need a way of explaining why they're losers. And anti-Semitism is a good excuse. It's a way of shifting responsibility over to others without having to take it yourself. Jean-Paul Sartre, the great French philosopher, once said that the anti-Semite turns himself to stone. And I think that's right. What happens is that people make themselves impervious to criticism. They have an answer for everything, an explanation for everything, and it works.
So your book is called A Rumor About the Jews. Now let's show it on television.
Yes, let's show it on television.
What does it really mean, a rumor about the Jews? It's sort of a vague description. It's a nice, pretty cover, but it's a vague description. Tell us what you're trying to point out in this book.
I guess the basic idea behind the title is that, and the reason I chose it was that anti-Semitism today has receded. It's no longer the respected the way it used to be. One has to remember this was taught in universities in Europe. This had a very respected tradition.
You mean the elders of Zion?
That I don't know if it was taught in colleges,
right.
but although under Hitler it was taught in the schools, but it certainly was a highly respected piece of work that was the basis of enormous debate.
Explain to the audience a little bit about who wrote that and how it came about.
It's actually a very good story.
That's why we asked.
Okay. Well, actually it's a forgery, and the forgery was done after the first Zionist Congress, which was led by the great Theodor Herzl, founder of modern Zionism. And what happened was basically the following. Some police agents of the Russian secret police, the Okhrana, were in Paris. And they were members of basically the right-wing faction in the court. And they were always looking for anti-Semitic materials. And they decided, they came across in a salon, they came across a book which they could use, a book by a Republican, actually.
What do you mean a Republican?
He was a real Republican, the guy who wrote the book. It was called The Dialogue in Hell.
Republican where?
In France in the 19th century. This is, now we're talking...
Well, people think that it was George Bush, you know.
We got no, not the Republican Party.
Right,
Republican
right.
With a small r.
Right.
And so here's this guy who wrote a book against dictatorship called Dialogue in Hell, a dialogue between two philosophers, Montesquieu, the great French philosopher, liberal, and Machiavelli. And basically what they decided to do was lift parts of this book, and transform it. And they transformed it into an anti-Semitic tract, which basically said that the Jews had, that a council of leading, elders of Zion had taken place, and they had come together to take over the world. That was the basic thrust of it. They put together this book with part of a novel, part of an anti-Semitic novel, named Biarritz. These are all forgotten today. But what's important is they created out of these two books a forgery, which had a tremendous impact.
It was a textbook for anti-Semitism, basically.
Textbook for a catechism
you
for
gotta, anti-Semitism. The audience should understand that the First World Congress, Zionist Congress, was led by Theodor Herzl, who most of you know was covering the Dreyfus case as a reporter and was very upset about the anti-Semitism against Dreyfus and started the whole Zionist movement. But concomitantly in Russia, there was this PAL, the movement of anti-Semitism against many Jews, where people like Chaim Weizmann came out of. And the anti-Semitism under the Tsar was so prolific and omnivorous that a lot of Zionism was started because of these anti-Semitic virtues of those countries. And that's the way, basically, you got the Zionist state.
Interestingly enough, the salon that I just mentioned that took place in Paris, two people who frequented the salon, was one of them was the person who was guilty in the Zionist, in the Dreyfus affair.
Really?
That was Esterhazy. Yeah, and his best friend, his name was Edmond Drumont, who published an anti-Semitic journal for years and years and years, very popular, sold in the hundreds of thousands. And anyway, this came about, and it was brought back to Russia, and it was published in 1903, just in time to greet a revolution that was taking place in Russia. In fact, it was a lot of people called it the dress rehearsal for the revolution
in 1917.
And when the Tsar and the Tsarina, who've gotten an incredibly good press, I mean, one talks about the Teflon president,
They were really true anti-Semites.
These were real idiots.
They really were. I remember people talking about them. They were terrible. You know, if you saw Fiddler on the Roof, you basically got a gist of it in a Broadway play. But the Tsar was a terrible, terrible anti-Semite.
Raving anti-Semite.
Raving, right, anti-Semite. Yeah.
And also in its own way anti-Western.
And by the way, the people saw the communist movement were Jewish guys. Basically.
Well, one of the things that you asked before, why this is so attractive. Well, if you're in power and you're not willing to admit your mistakes, one of the ways of explaining why a revolution should take place in a society that was supposedly ordered by God, there's one excellent way to explain it, and that is to blame the Jews for inspiring it. And of course, you're quite right. In the labor movement, not just communist, but socialist, at the time, democratic socialist, many Jews were in the forefront. And so it was easy to create a stereotype.
Right. Yeah. Do you track your book? How far do you go? Do you go through the 20th century? You get up to Hitler and you do?
Yeah.
And how did he use the Elders of Zion?
Well, the way it worked was, it's sort of, a fairly interesting story. After the 1905 revolution took place.
In Russia. Right.
And the protocols were read in every church by order of the Tsar. Yeah, at every mass. After the revolution.
Tsar, I have a question for you. Yeah. Was the Tsar the chief religious figure in Russian Orthodoxy, or you don't know?
Was he the chief religious figure? No.
In other words, the Queen of England is.
No, he's not head of the. He's not head of the church.
But he could mandate what the church is.
Yeah, because
basically, he was the Tsar.
The king is the king. And the church itself was the Russian Orthodox Church was vehemently anti-Semitic. So there was no real problem here. Anyway.
No real problem. So finding an anti-Semite was not a problem.
Not a problem.
They were
in
all
Russia.
Available. You're right.
Yeah. And it was actually became the textbook for the famous Black Hundreds of 1905. The Black Hundreds were a group that organized pogroms within
pogroms in the great
cities. And they sort of almost served as a type of prototype for the later for Hitler's brown shirts and so on. But the point is that after the revolution was quelled, they sort of receded from view, the protocols did. But they emerged again in 1917 with the Russian Revolution. And after that came a civil war in 1918, a very bloody, very terrible civil war between the Reds and the old counter-revolutionary supporters of the old regime, who were called the Whites. And after the loss of the Whites, there it was distributed all over Russia and all over the Baltic. And what happened?
The Reds distributed this?
No, no, the Whites.
No, the Whites, not the Reds. Whites. The Reds had a lot of Jews.
Yeah. The Reds had their explanation for what was happening, for the First World War and so on, which was Marxism.
Right.
The Whites needed an explanation.
Right. Oh, so they blamed the Jews.
And it's all, it can be, in the protocols, what the authors said about it, these, was that the Jews planned to instigate wars, they planned to instigate economic collapse, they planned to actually spread disease among the populace.
All right, we got to cut for a break.
Sure.
If you remember, about 2-3 years ago, we held a series of programs about the secret war against the Jews, a book written by John Loftus, and he was not a Jewish man. I think, Stephen, you are Jewish. Mm. And it was, people read that book and they shivered. And I believe that there'll be a mini-series about John Loftus' book, so you can look forward to it. We'll be right back after break. Continue with Stephen Branagh.
Full life, measured in seats, starts with the right ones early on. Car crashes are the number one killer of children 1 through 13. Learn how to prevent deaths and injuries by using the right car seat for your child's age and size.
Kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
Every book is an adventure waiting to come to life. Visit new worlds. Encounter new friends. And discover the power of reading. Go to read.gov to read A Princess of Mars, the first novel to feature John Carter. A new world awaits. Read.
The average text takes your eyes off the road for nearly 5 seconds.
Closer to nature can get you closer to your family. Go to discovertheforest.org.
Osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
I help you find a home.
I help you find a home.
Hey, maybe you'll be picked next.
Maybe you'll be picked next.
We've been caged together too long.
We've been caged together too long.
How come nobody ever picks me?
Maybe they're looking for somebody different.
Pick me.
Well, the shelter's closing up for another day.
We didn't get picked.
I know. guaranteed.
We're back. We're talking to Stephen Brano, who is a professor at the university, or Rutgers University, my old town, by the way. Where's that, New Brunswick?
Mm-hmm.
I was born in New Jersey. And he has written a book called A Rumor About the Jews, Reflections of Anti-Semitism and the Protocols of Learned Elders of Zion. Elders of Zion was the worst manifesto of anti-Semitism ever written in the world since Gutenberg had a press. And he dissects it and talks about it and how it's permeated the world. We were talking, I want to talk about two people diametrically apart. One is Joe Lieberman, what he has ramifications to the world and anti-Semitism, and then Henry Ford, who everybody wished Firestone Tires to. Henry Ford was a rampant, nasty, anti-Semitic human being. How about Lindbergh? Him too?
Him too.
He too. My English is better. He too.
He too.
But tell us about Ford, because he was a publisher of this stuff too, right?
Well, Ford, Henry Ford was the person who, he's actually the only, I think he's the only non-German that Hitler quotes at Mein Kampf. It's interesting.
That's true. I read that one in someplace.
And he was a rampant anti-Semite. He was, of course, also anti-black. And it's important, I think, for people to know that anti-Semitism never stands alone. It's always connected with other forms of racism. And I argue in the book that it's always connected with an attack on the principles of the Enlightenment, the principles of democracy, principles of liberalism, and actually the principles of socialism, too.
Right. So the big question, Joe Lieberman is nominated to be the first vice presidential nominee for the United States of America. He's an Orthodox or observant Jew, he likes to call it. Do you believe that this will cause anti-Semitism or negate it?
Will it cause anti-Semitism?
According to your theory, he's an enlightened person, right?
Yeah, anti-Semitism took hold in different countries in different ways, to different extents. And the historical and political reasons why it was stronger in, let's say, Russia and then in Germany than
why?
It was in England and
why?
In the United States. Because I think the places
economics?
Where... I don't think it was just economics.
Really?
I don't.
Okay.
I think that's a mistaken view. Because in America, too, America experienced the Depression. It didn't have a Hitler result. It's true there were fascist figures like Father Conklin and so on. But I think the key thing is the existence of democratic institutions and also the existence of democratic traditions. And those places which had those, I don't want to say they were immune from anti-Semitism, but anti-Semitism was relegated to a non-political, let's say, social
existence. All right, so let's go slow. This is important. You're saying that anti-Semitism rises in dictatorships?
Anti-Semitism is the best breeding ground for anti-Semitism are places which have a strong anti-democratic, anti-Enlightenment tradition and a strong tradition of feudalism.
Can you prove that in your book?
I try to show it, yeah. And I think if you think about it, though, it's, it doesn't take Einstein to sort of see that in Russia, which was a backwater of the real backwater of civilization before the Russian Revolution. I mean, there was almost 90% illiteracy. There was no tradition of capitalist development.
All right,
tradition,
but Stephen,
of
let's go.
Democracy.
World War II. Many French people turned against the Jews. Many Italians turned. And of course, there were very good ones too. If you go through the history now of Finland and Sweden and the Dutch, there's new evidence coming out that not all these countries were that great for the Jews.
I don't want to say that anti-Semitism didn't exist there. All I want to say is you have to be able to draw distinctions between places where chances are it's really going to be virulent and places where it's going to take a more benign form. I don't want to say it doesn't exist.
Let's march back in history 50 years where it'd be nearly impossible for a Jew to get a job in banking in mm-hmm. America. Maybe a white-collar
That's right.
firm they couldn't get into. White. Was that anti-Semitism?
Yeah. I try and draw in the book a distinction between different forms of anti-Semitism. And I'll try and do it sort of briefly, but I think it's useful.
Very.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because everybody knows there's a history of anti-Semitism out there. But it took different forms in different ways. One way it really grabbed home originally was, of course, in religious terms. And in a certain way, what this meant was that Jews would be hated not as people, but as Jews. What I mean by that is you could convert. And in principle, things would be okay then. After the Enlightenment, however, it was different. You were hated not simply as a Jew, but as a person. And what I mean by that is the following. You could be a Jew, but you had to sit in the ghetto. People got upset, anti-Semites were upset, when Jews tried to enter the public realm, which is what you're talking about. They wanted to go into different professions. They wanted to go into the public wheel. And this was the great scare, and I call that a form of social anti-Semitism, or in Yiddish you call it rishis. Rishis, which means a type of resentment, a fear that the Jews are too good, a fear that the Jews are taking over, and so on.
So inferiority complex.
Yeah, yeah. And and the third form of anti-Semitism is one in which it's really political. And that form of political anti-Semite hates the Jew as a Jew, and he hates him as and the anti-Semite hates him as a person as well.
Does he use it for political purposes to graduate himself into different positions?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying? In other words, it would behoove somebody to go to an area, let's say want to be elected for something. Let's take Duke out in Louisiana,
yeah.
right? So he's a virulent anti-Semite, and he professes to be. He thinks that will sell in his area and therefore elect him?
Exactly.
And are there many cases in history like this?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you want to think of it in these terms, what was new about the Nazis was that they wedded anti-Semitism to a political worldview. That was anti-liberal, anti-socialist, anti-progressive, and they made it into the cornerstone of their entire ideology. And this was new at the time.
Now why did Hitler get so crazy about Jews and anti-Semitism? Have you researched that a lot?
Personally, there's no consensus on it.
No?
In fact, there's not even a consensus that it was really a principled hatred of Jews. It could have been also tinged with opportunism. And there's a lot of debate about that among scholars. I personally think that it was when he was young in Vienna, his anti-Semitism was formed, and it became part, not the whole thing, but part of an assault on the Republic that existed in Germany between the 1918 in 1933, and it was a way of explaining to Germans why they had lost the war, why they had had an economic crisis, and why the democracy they had seemed to pit one faction of people against the others. And for this, the protocols was perfect.
All right, but wouldn't Hitler's anti-Semitism back itself into the First World War and the terrible unemployment and depression that Germany had right after that? So economics, wouldn't that have played a great role in Hitler?
A great role indeed. But the question is how you explain it. It wasn't just that we got a problem here and we got to reform it through the existing democracy. Hitler's claim was the democracy itself is permeated by Jews. And he spoke of what was called the Weimar Republic as the Jew Republic. So there was no reform. Duke has never been able to make that step.
We're running out of time. Why did he think, what caused him to try and eliminate Jews totally? I mean, destroy them, kill them, put them in, do you know anything about that?
Yeah,
this?
I think, I'm trying to make an argument about that in the book too. And I think the reason is what's unique about anti-Semitism as against other forms of racism. You know, if you think of normal racists, the way they look at blacks, you can say, or they would say, they're lazy, they're a drain on the economy, they get preferred treatment, and so on. But nobody's going to say that blacks run America, right? For the Jews, what Hitler was able to do and what Jewish anti-Semitism lends itself to is that the Jew becomes a chameleon. The Jew can be anything. He's Rothschild the banker, and he's Rosa Luxemburg the revolutionary. He's the avant-garde artist, and he's your straight teacher down the street.
So he's ubiquitous in a way.
Yeah, I call him a chameleon. And that the strength that anti-Semitism has, the places where it's strongest is the places where what I call the chameleon effect is strongest.
I see. Interesting theory. What's the future of the United States? Are we having a lot of anti-Semitism? Is it receding?
Well, I think what's happening in general as a political force and as a social force that can attract masses of people, I think it's receding. But I think there's still people around who are into this in a profound way. I mean, we all know that. And the place for organizing, the place for pushing their ideas is on the net. Now,
That's a good point.
Now, interestingly enough, on the net, I checked this out, where they talk about conspiracy, the hits on conspiracy.
Right. Go ahead.
Almost every place you turn to, the conspiracy theorists think Satan really exists, and he's in league with the Jews. With those people, you can't argue.
We're running out of time, so but, the rumor about the Jews. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just going
to
say.
To you.
But people who believe that Satan is on the march, really existing on the earth, is not going to be able to have a mass public.
So you're optimistic.
I'm optimistic.
We'll see you next week. We leave anti-Semitism with optimism. That's anachronism, I think, but we'll see next week. We'll test it.